Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Do you love music? I mean, really, really love music. The different kinds, the way it brings people together, the way it makes you feel. Well, then I'm sorry to do this to you, but...
We actually sound like a halfway decent band.
We do?
Yeah, he's right. We've never sounded this good.
It's a scary thought. One thing's for sure, we sound loud.
Yeah, I kind of hope that neighbors don't call the cops. I got a couple of priors out, shoplifting and whatnot.
They've never called the cops, they're not going to start now.
They must be deaf.
That is from the film Losers Take All, and you'll be relieved to know that, yes, it is supposed to be funny. Though, actually, a hardcore punk song about a squirt gun is kind of a great idea. Anyway, today on Soundcheck, we'll meet the director of the film, which charts the progress, or lack thereof, of an underground rock band in the mid-1980s. We'll also hear from Memphis roots rocker John Paul Keith. He wrote the film's theme song, which is not about squirt guns, and basically put the actors through a kind of musical boot camp so they'd be convincing as an energetic but unfortunate rock band. Plus, John Paul and his real band will play some good old-fashioned, no-frills rock and roll for us here in the Soundcheck studio. But let's start with an actor who has been convincing in a number of roles over the years. Convincing enough to win 5 Emmys, 2 Tonys, and 2 Golden Globes. John Lithgow was a transsexual ex-football player in the world according to Garp. He meant to lead an alien invasion of Earth, but stuff kept getting in the way in the TV sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. He revealed his inner Broadway belter in The Sweet Smell of Success, and more recently played a super scary serial killer in the Showtime series Dexter. But John Lithgow has another career, children's author, and his latest book is called Never Play Music, Right Next to the Zoo. John Lithgow, welcome to Soundcheck.
Very, very nice to be here, John.
So when did you, was this like in between episodes of Mass Murder that you wrote this book?
Actually, in truth, I wrote it about 10 years ago. And collaborated with a wonderful composer, Bill Elliott. And we have been performing it ever since with various orchestras. It's a child's guide to the orchestra piece, a sort of fun musical story, which I have finally turned into a children's picture book.
So was the intent from day one that it would be a kind of a musical thing as well as a picture book?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. The whole premise of it is, in the course of the song, the spoken song narration, in the musical background, the musical arrangement, the instruments bit by bit sound like they're being played by animals, making a good faith effort to play music. And it's very, very funny. It's like a musical joke.
Yeah. And sort of like, I mean, it's not quite in the vein of Peter and the Wolf or you know, Benjamin Britten's Young People's Guide. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like this is what a bassoon sounds like, but it is like this is what an orchestra sounds like if the animals got at
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And there's a whole section of it where different animals play different instruments, and you hear them in the scoring. Bill is an ingenious arranger, so mm-hmm. he did that too.
And he's the conductor of the orchestra that we hear in the recording.
Yeah.
This is the recording that comes with John Lithgow's book. It's called Never Play Music, Right Next to the Zoo.
The soft summer air was so balmy and sweet, and the program was running so long that I found myself falling asleep in my seat. Despite all the music and song, All at once, the conductor erupted with rage. A band of wild animals was storming the stage. Oh, children, remember, whatever you may do, never play music right next to the zoo. They'll burst from their cages, each beast and each bird, desperate to play all the music they've heard. The lions and the elephants, the bears and the raccoons, will steal away the trumpets, the flutes and bassoons, replace the musicians and chase them away. Then they'll sit in the band shell and play.
That is my guest, John Lithgow, the celebrated actor who is also, this is by no means your first children's effort.
It's my ninth, actually.
Yeah. But it certainly is a musical one. Never play music right next to the zoo. You have several clever rhymes for bassoon. Are you a fan of the bassoon in particular?
You notice that I've overused the word bassoon in my rhymes. Not really. I only go according to what fits the rhythm and the rhyme, which is why I end up using so many ridiculous words.
You've also written a lot about animals.
Mm-hmm.
I got two dogs. I'm a manatee.
Yes.
Carnival of the animals.
Marsupial Sue, the young kangaroo.
So, I mean, does this grow out of your own experience with your own kids? I mean, kids love stories about animals.
Kids do love stories about animals. And certainly songs about animals. Almost all of my kids' books, of the nine, seven of them are things that I do in concert with kids. And somehow or other, animals creep into practically everything. The codfish ball, the hippo song, you know, I'm a gnu. And in fact, in concert, I play a game with the kids, guess the animals, where I start drawing the animal. They have to guess what it is before I finish.
Now, the gnu song, is that an original thing, or is that the old
Flanders and Swan? No, I've rifled
through. Another gnu.
Exactly. and mud, glorious mud. And I find songs from Betty Boop and Shirley Temple and Cab Calloway and Danny Kaye. I just love going through Tin Pan Alley history and finding things that can be retooled for kids.
So when your kids were younger, were they a kind of lab, were they test cases for you? Did you?
Somewhat. I certainly began entertaining kids when I had my own kids. My oldest is 41 years old, so I've been doing it a long time. But I started becoming a big deal pretty much when I became famous through Third Rock from the Sun, and I got an opportunity to make albums and do Carnegie Hall concerts. By that time, I was a terrible embarrassment to my kids. They'd outgrown me.
So there are all these children's books, and then there are the albums, like Singing in the Bathtub, which is, a collection of these older songs. Including a version of A, You're Adorable. This again, my guest, John Lithgow.
Now here's the song that goes along with the letters. Are you ready? Here goes. A, you're adorable. B, you're so beautiful. C, you're a cutie full of charm. D, you're a darling. And E, you're exciting. And F, you're a feather in my arms. G, you look good to me. H, you're so heavenly. I, you're the one I idolize. J, we're like Jack and Jill. K, you're so kissable. L is the love light in your eyes. M, N, O, P. I can go on all day. Q, R, S, T. Alphabetically speaking, you're okay. And you made my life complete. V, you're so very sweet. W, X, Y, Z. It's fun to wander through the alphabet with you to tell you what you mean to me. Now this time,
John Lithgow and friends.
little friends.
A, you're adorable, from his album Singing in the Bathtub. John Lithgow's latest book for kids is called Never Play Music Right Next to the Zoo. It is out now with illustrations by Lisa Hernandez and music by Bill Elliott, who conducts the orchestra on the CD that comes with the book. John will be doing a book signing tomorrow, Saturday morning, 11 a.m., at McNally Jackson on Prince Street in Soho here in New York. So what kind of music did you grow up with in the house?
Actually, a lot of the songs that I have sort of remembered. Danny Kaye was a huge thing in our household.
He did that Tubby the Tube. Was that Danny Kaye?
Danny Kaye, he did everything.
Yeah, I think but he did Tubby the Tuba.
And he did a wonderful sort of novelty concerts for adults. I mean, he was really a great, almost vaudevillian. He had Danny at the Palace was a record we must have played 1,000 times. It had triplets. It had the lobby number. I did triplets on Singing in the Bathtub, the Singing in the Bathtub album, singing all three roles in triplets, three little unexpected children simultaneously. And my sister and I would sing them all together. My parents, you know, they were great big band era jazz aficionados. We always had Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller playing in the house.
So when the rock and roll era came in the 50s, would that have been, I'm trying to do the math here, would that have been in your sweet spot?
Yeah, I would say sixth grade, Elvis Presley was, that was Don't Be Cruel, yeah. Hound Dog.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that I internalized that too.
So, you know, earlier this week on the show, we were talking with a number of writers about, and some of our listeners about that one music teacher. It didn't have to be a music teacher. It could have been an English teacher, a soccer coach, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. That one teacher who sort of like kind of turned your life around, you know, left a lasting impression.
Yeah.
Did you have that one person?
I had a couple of great, great teachers. I must say, until about the age 18, I was fully intending to be an artist and not an actor.
A visual artist.
Yeah. And I had a great teacher in Akron, Ohio, in the public school system named Fran Robinson, who was an artist herself. And it was a wonderful era of art in schools. I had two periods of art at the beginning of every single school day. It was like going to art school in ninth and 10th grade.
Yeah.
And that's when I became very, very serious about painting. Unfortunately, I heard a little bit too much laughter and applause as soon as I got to college. I'd grown up in a theater family, so I was destined and doomed to be an actor instead.
You discovered all that USDA grade A ham within.
Exactly.
And
a great disappointment to Fran Robinson. God bless her.
Yet you still remember her name, shows the kind of importance.
I even remember specific instructions and lessons from her. I remember her making a difference in my own art technique. Those people really brand you. I also had a great, great language teacher a little later named Carmine Prezioso, who was an incredibly theatrical,
what a great name,
very
too.
Italian language teacher teaching me French. Somehow he made me speak French in a single year.
Carmine Prezioso taught you French.
Yes, he was a polyglot. Okay. You know, many languages. I think he taught me the word polyglot, as a matter of fact.
Well, you have been kind of a polymath as an actor. You know, you've done the whole range from comic to really beyond tragic to like super creepy and scary. I saw you in the Chicago version of Sweet Smell of Success before it came
prior to Broadway.
And I think the big surprise to me in that production was you as Song and Dance Man. I didn't know that was like a part of your DNA.
Well, I'm very flattered that you think I am. I still feel that as a Song and Dance Man, I'm a great actor. But I love doing it. There's nothing quite like performing in a Broadway musical. And that was my first experience. I'd done plenty of singing on stage, but all of it in college prior to becoming a pro. You do find as an actor that there are two different worlds, the legit world and the musical world in Broadway theater, and they very rarely intersect.
Why is that?
It's a different discipline in so many ways. You know, there are those unique moments like Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady or Robert Preston in The Music Man or Richard Kiley in Man of La Mancha when an actor actually gets to, it's like unleashing an actor because it really is giving you a chance that you ordinarily don't get. Everybody else is so much better than you at these things.
Well, you not only did well, but won a Tony for Best Leading Actor.
Well, nice of you to remind people.
For the portrayal of J.J. Hunsaker in the Marvin Hamlisch musical called Sweet Smell of Success, here is John Lithgow in that role singing Don't Look Now.
Magicians always tell you they got nothing up their sleeve. But why would someone tell you that unless it's to deceive? There's always been a lie to misdirect the eye since Adam did his magic tricks for Eve. Don't ever trust a gent who pulls a bird from someone's ear, who makes his living making you believe that he's sincere. He's looking for a chump, expecting you to jump, when he pours on all the charm and says, I need a volunteer. Don't look now, but something that you had is gone. It's something you depend upon. Don't look now. Take a bow. Someone made a fool of you.
That is John Lithgow, my guest on Soundcheck, the celebrated actor who is also an author and singer for kids and adults.
That's right.
That's going back over a decade.
Yeah, that was 12 years ago. Marvin Hamlisch, rest his soul.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing experience working with Marvin and John Guare and Nick Heitner and Christopher Wheeldon. And Craig Carnelia, who wrote the lyrics.
And Christopher Wheeldon, the choreographer, who has gone on to great acclaim in that, in that field in the 10 years since. It was 2002 that you won the Tony for Sweet Smell of Success.
I have to say, that's the first time I've heard me singing that in about 10 years.
Yeah.
It's thrilling. I'd forgotten all the words.
Now, jumping to something quite different, I mean, recently you were on a series of Dexter, playing his kind of almost like competing serial killer, suppose. You know, having the opportunity to do a role like that, I mean, is part of the lore of that, again, this is something people won't expect from you?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. Anytime you get the chance to upend people's expectations, you can manipulate them in all sorts of ways.
Right.
I had the same experience when I first did Third Rock, and nobody had seen me clown around like that. Nobody had seen me be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And just when they're completely accustomed to me being funny and domesticated, I play a hideous, terrifying serial killer whose cover is being a very normal, almost inconspicuous man.
So do you find people approaching you out on the street a little differently these days?
Well, fortunately, they sort of remember Third Rock, too, and they're so tickled that I did both things. It's nice to be known for doing many things rather than being very well known for doing one.
John Lithgow with us on Soundcheck today. The new book for kids comes with a CD. It's called Never Play Music, Right Next to the Zoo. You actually, in Footloose, in the movie Footloose, you play the pastor who hates
rock
dancing.
Rock and roll music. Yes, you're right.
That sounds like that was really playing against type for you.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we shot that film, it was me and Diane Wiest and a whole bunch of young, early 20-year-olds, if not teenagers, in Provo, Utah, a fairly straight-laced town.
Mm-hmm.
And Diane and I were the wild ones. We almost got in some serious trouble there.
You're not going to go into detail?
Well, I do remember there was a memo posted the morning after we all swam nude in the motel pool. They're still talking about it in Provo.
Now, one of your kids, one of your sons is, by your own description, a sommelier and a rock bassist.
That's right.
I got that off your website.
Yeah.
So do you listen to that? What kind of music does he play? I mean, what species of rock?
I don't know enough about rock these days to be able to give it a title, but it's indie rock. Him and he's created a band called Elder Brother. brand new. I mean, they've only performed live about three times, but he's worked with a couple of bands. He's played with My Brightest Diamond.
Oh.
I believe I've heard them on this very show.
Absolutely. Shara Warden.
Yeah, Shara. He's toured with Shara. He's seen more cities in the world than I have.
So what do you listen to these days if it's not, you know, what your son is playing?
I'm afraid I'm a classical music listener. I listen to classical music practically all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so out of it when it comes to what's really happening. I don't know why I don't catch up. I'm too lazy, really.
Well, you know, but we find that there are a lot of, especially in like your son's generation, a mm-hmm. lot of musicians for whom those distinctions between classical and rock are, I mean.
Absolutely.
Nico Muhly, whose opera is at the Met right now.
Yeah.
You know, a guy who's worked with Bjork and The National and all these other rock stars. And,
yeah.
Moves
yeah.
very freely between those worlds.
Well, so. I know that's true. But, I mean, I'm not being a musician myself, you know, it's one of my great regrets in life that I was never really trained at anything when I was a kid. And I only learned mediocre guitar when I started entertaining kids. I'm sort of inflexible, I guess. I mean, I just can't go there.
For someone whose career has shown a lot of versatility, I don't believe that at all. John Lithgow, the actor and writer and singer, has been with us on Soundcheck. His new book is called Never Play Music Right Next to the Zoo. It is out now, and John will be at McNally Jackson, the bookstore on Prince Street in Soho, tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. for a book signing. And John, it has been a real pleasure having you
John,
with us.
I'm so flattered that you would have me here, really.
Oh, children, remember, whatever you may do, never play music right next to the zoo. They'll burst from their cages, each beast and each bird, desperate to play all the music they've heard. Yeah. No, never play music right next to the zoo. And pay strict attention to rule number two. Bear it in mind for the rest of your days. Don't fall asleep when an orchestra plays.
Up next, an in-studio performance by singer-songwriter John Paul Keith. He's from Memphis, and that matters, as you'll hear. And a look at the new movie, Losers Take All, about a fictional band working in the 1980s punk scene. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A great American music mecca plays a starring role in the new album called Memphis, Circa 3 AM. By singer-songwriter John Paul Keith, an adopted son of Memphis. He's joined me here in the Soundcheck studio with his band today. And speaking of starring roles, one of John Paul Keith's songs has a big part in a new independent film set in the world of underground rock in 1986. We'll hear more about that album and that movie in a moment. But first, let's hear John Paul Keith and his band live in the studio with You Really Oughta Be With Me.
Like to see your face close to mine in a dim little place. Conscience and my schedule's clear. Call me up, you disappear. Hey, pretty baby, can't you see? I think you really ought to be with me. Mm-hmm. Woman, you ain't no little child. I must confess, you got me right. I think you really
That is John Paul Keith live on Soundcheck with his song You Really Ought to Be With Me. You heard John Paul singing and playing the guitar with John Argroves behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio and James Godwin playing the bass. That's the lead-off track on John Paul's latest record called Memphis Circa 3 a.m., which is out now. And John Paul, first of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
What is going on in Memphis around 3 a.m., other than FedEx packages being delivered and shipped out?
Well, that's about the closing time in Tennessee. That's when they shut the bars down. But and being a musician, you know, I see a lot of that, you know. See a lot of bars at 3 a.m. closing out, and it's kind of a particular vibe I think we've all been through at a time or two in our life, and that just sort of played into the writing of the record. You know, I was spending a lot of time in that mindset, so that's sort of where that came from.
If people have not been to Memphis, you know, it's famous for Beale Street,
right?
You know, the great music scene there. I know when I went to Memphis, I was stunned at how tiny Beale Street is.
Yes.
I mean, it's literally like a couple of blocks long.
A couple of blocks, yeah.
And that's it.
Yep.
And yet that couple of blocks is enough, it seems.
Yeah, it was, especially back in the day, it was very, very important, you know, back in the segregation days. That was the place for African Americans to go for entertainment and drinking, you know, was on Beale, and that's, you know, B.B. King and Rufus Thomas and Albert King and all those guys came out of that world, you know. But and also in West Memphis, there was what it was curfew in Memphis at the time, but in West Memphis, Arkansas, across the river, another state, there was no curfew, so that's a lot of the Memphis sound came from that, too.
Oh, okay. So how much, it sounds like the city of Memphis has really sort of played a big kind of starring role, as I said earlier, in this new record.
Yeah. Part of that was the way we recorded it. We recorded at Sam Phillips Recording Service, which is the studio that Sam Phillips of Sun Records built when he sold Sun in 1960. Sun was just in a little radiator shop. It was tiny. It was always makeshift.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam Phillips Recording, was built to be a studio, and it was state-of-the-art at the time. And it's still in business, and the man who produced the record had been there since 1983.
That's Roland James.
Roland James, who unfortunately passed away earlier this week, so at the age of 80. So we were very saddened to hear that. We were on the road and missed the funeral and everything. So I hated to hear that. We loved Roland, and it was the most rewarding recording experience of my life, and I think for the other guys as well.
Now he was associated with Sun Records.
He was for
a while, you know, long going way 50s, way back
in the 50s. He was sort of a house guitarist there, and he played guitar on all of the Jerry Lee Lewis recordings at Sun. Maybe 150 plus recordings with Jerry Lee there, including Great Balls of Fire and a whole lot of shaking going on. You've heard Roland James play guitar your whole life, trust me. You just didn't know it, you know.
Yeah,
it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He was on all the Billy Lee Riley stuff, and then. Then later on, he moved to he left Sun, started his own label, Rita Records, for a minute. They put out the first version of Mountain of Love, the Johnny Rivers hit. It was a hit first for a local guy, Harold Dorman, and Roland produced that. And then Johnny Rivers heard that record and covered it. So
this guy is like woven into the history.
Absolutely,
of Memphis.
Absolutely.
So your record must have been one of the last things he did.
As far as we know, I think it was the last commercial release. I know he was doing sessions right up to the end, but I think our record was the last commercially released album that he did. And I'm quite certain we did the last 45 single he ever put out, you know, that he ever worked on, because we have a new single out as well that he produced. So,
and so people are releasing 45-inch vinyl now? Is that coming back?
Oh, it's been back.
I mean, I know vinyl is back, but the
we do the 7-inch. Yeah,
it's, you do the singles?
We have two actually. They do a little better for us in Europe than they do here. But yeah, they're fun. You know, if you have a jukebox in your house, we got you. We can hook you up.
I don't happen to have a jukebox in my New York City house. we're speaking with John Paul Keith, and the album we're talking about is called Memphis Circa 3 a.m. You were not always, you're not a Memphis boy. You're not
no,
a native.
No,
you've,
no.
You've gone all over, haven't you?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Knoxville, Tennessee. And by the way, I need to give a shout out to my dad in Knoxville. Yesterday was his birthday, and I almost forgot. So happy belated birthday, Dad. I'm sure he's at home listening. But yeah, I grew up in Knoxville, and Was in Nashville for about 5 years in the late 90s. I did the whole Nashville thing, was in a few bands there and with varying degrees of success, if you want to call it that. And then kind of got burnt out on that. Came here for a little bit in 2002. I was in New York for about 6 months, but I just couldn't make ends meet. It was just too much, you know, like it is for a lot of people, especially musicians. So found myself in Alabama for a couple of years, and then my sister lived in Memphis and had been for years. She worked there, and she said, "Why don't you go to Memphis and give it a shot for a while?" And I was kind of burnt out and had no intention of playing. And when I got there, of course, it being Memphis and music is just everywhere. It just next thing you knew, I was playing again. And
so, had you actually walked away from music for a while?
I had. I'd kind of hit the wall with trying to be in a band and put out records and push yourself and do the whole thing. I just got burnt, you know, just burned out with it, and decided I was just going to try something else. And it didn't last long, especially in Memphis. Memphis totally recharged my batteries very quickly.
So Nashville and Memphis, they share a state.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing the sound is pretty different. I mean, when you were in Nashville, that was sort of more alt-country kind of stuff.
Well, in the late 90s, Nashville was still just straight-up mainstream country. I mean, there was an underground there, and there kind of always has been, but there was a rock scene, but it didn't get the attention or have the kind of respect that it has now. Nashville's completely different now.
It's
really changed a lot. We were just there last week, and It's really stunning how much the city's grown and how much it's changed. There was no East Nashville scene or any of that stuff when I lived there. But that said, Memphis has always sort of been, you know, the best description. I don't know who said this. I heard somebody say this one time. You know, Nashville is Metropolis and Memphis is Gotham. You know, Memphis is a little dirtier and rougher and funkier and a lot of ways more soulful. It's smaller. The scene is much smaller, and it's not for everybody. But for me, for whatever reason, it just lined up. All the great musicians there, and it's just been perfect for me.
Well, and this album, Memphis Circa 3 AM, I mean, it has a kind of classic gut bucket kind of roots rock and roll sound to it.
That's Memphis, and that's also a big part of that was Roland. I mean, the way we recorded it was 100% analog, 2-inch tape. Roland had no computer in the building, didn't know how to use one, didn't care to learn. You know, he was 79 years old when we started the record.
Right.
So it was recorded the way records used to be recorded.
Yeah, and again, that's Roland Jaynes, who recently passed away, the rockabilly guitarist and producer of John Paul Keith's record, Memphis Circa 3 AM. You want to do Anyone Can Do It for us next?
Sure, let's do that.
All right. Once again, John Argroves is playing the drums, James Godwin on bass, John Paul Keith will strap on the guitar. They're playing for us live in the Soundcheck studio. This song is called Anyone Can Do It.
Even you can have a hit sound.
Once again, John Paul Keith and his band live on Soundcheck, and that song's called Anyone Can Do It, an original song from John Paul that is featured in a new movie called Losers Take All, which is about a young underground band trying to make it in the 1980s. In a moment, we'll hear more about that movie and John Paul's role in it, sort of behind the scenes, and we'll talk with the film's director. That is coming up. Stay where you are. This is Soundcheck.
That's a song, man. It should be us.
That'll never be us.
Oh, come on, why not?
First of all, bad brains are black. Second of all, we can't keep a band together.
Dude, relax. We'll find a new drummer.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and that is a scene from the new movie Losers Take All. It's a comedy set in the world of underground rock circa 1986, and the two characters you just heard there, Brian and Dave, played by Kyle Gallner and Aaron Himmelstein, eventually do put together a band called The Fingers that proves, what a surprise, to be somewhat hapless. A moment ago, we heard our in-studio guest musician John Paul Keith playing the theme song from Losers Take All, and now we're joined as well by the director, Alex Steiermark. Alex, good to have you back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So this is basically... do you know the book Our Band Could Be Your Life by Michael Azarad?
Yes.
You have done like the comedy version of that book, you know, the underground scene of the 1980s.
That's a compliment. A lot of credit is due to Wynn Kozlik and Andrew Pope, who are the screenwriters, and all three of us, I guess, had our musical coming of age during that era. So for us, it's... these were our favorite bands, and
Bands like Bad Brains, who we heard in the background.
Bad Brains
there.
That you just heard, and the Minutemen, and Husker Du, and and there's a whole great.
So it's the beginnings of what would become later indie rock.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. In fact, I would say that a lot of what is happening today was heavily influenced by that music.
Absolutely. Now, you use John Paul's song that he just played for us a moment ago, Anyone Can Do It. You use that like three times in the course of this movie.
We do. It sort of evolves. It has evolved into the theme song for the movie. You first see the band laying it down in their first chance. Oh, actually, you see them do it live. And you see them do it in their first shot at working in a big recording studio, and then ultimately the song is played over the end credits.
Well, you can be a hero, not a rock and roll hero. Well, you don't need a hit song if you don't want to live long.
Now, John Paul, you didn't write this song for the movie, right? This is on one of your earlier records.
No, actually, I did write it for the movie.
Really?
But I liked it so much I wanted to put it on my record, so I asked the screenwriters if they minded. So Andrew and Wynn, they were really cool about it. But yeah, I had been hired to just play guitar on the recording sessions for the music that the band would be seen playing, and they had already solicited songs from various different people. So we had 2 days of recording, and the first day... because that's how we do it in Memphis. We do it fast. The first day of recording, I realized that one of the songs was written by my good friend Jack Oblivion, who's a Memphis songwriter from the Oblivions, 90s sort of garage rock kingpin guy, and a great friend. And I said, oh, Jack's got a song, huh? And then my friend Ari Sertoval also had a song in it. And I was like, my friends all have songs in it, and I don't. So I went home that night after the first day and said, I got to come up with something for this. So I just through sheer force of will, it came out, you know, and the version you hear in the movie is more of a Ramones-y kind of version than what we do. But I came back the next day and pitched it to the team, and they went for it. So
and the idea anyone can do it. I mean, that's sort of that DIY ethos, Alex. That's part and parcel of this whole scene you're documenting.
That's right. I mean, that's basically the theme of the movie. You know, Brian and Dave, Kyle and Aaron say at the beginning of the movie, we need to start a band.
Right.
And that, I think, you know, that's that ethos is what informs it. And it also, I mean, that's, again, that's a timeless sort of philosophy now, you know.
It's timeless, but the movie is definitely rooted in its time period, the mid-1980s.
Yep.
And you've got, I mean, the soundtrack is extraordinary. I mean, bands that I don't think I've ever heard, licensed for film use before.
I think you're right. I think it's the first movie that all of these guys are in the same movie. That's for sure.
We've put together just a little, kind of series, a little collage of clips of some of the music from this new film called Losers Take All.
Some say my manners ain't the best. Some of my friends have been in a whole lot of trouble. And some say I'm no better than the rest. But tell your mama and your papa, sometimes good guys don't wear white.
Those are just three of the bands that appear in the soundtrack of the film Losers Take All. Minor Threat with Good Guys Don't Wear White, Husker Du with Games, and then Dinosaur Jr. with Little Fury Things. Alex Steiermark, director of the film, was it hard to... I mean, Minor Threat, for one, fiercely independent band. Were they at all reluctant to let you use their music?
Well, I gotta say, it was an honor and a compliment that all these bands, most of them had to see the scenes that their music was being used in before they would approve it. And so we had to prepare clips of all these things and send them out. And you know, it came back. They wanted to be involved. And that was a dream, because this was a wish list of tunes. And we got the ones that we wanted.
And the Minutemen and Black Flag and Guided by Voices and the Descendants and Alex Chilton, and you know, it really is a kind of time capsule of the great alternative rock bands of that time period. And now, against that backdrop, your hapless band, the Fingers, are trying to make their way, and mm-hmm. and this kind of sets up the. The comedic sensibility of the new movie, which, by the way, is available this weekend for on-demand viewing at outlets like iTunes and Hulu and various cable systems. Marshall Crenshaw is listed pretty prominently in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
What was his role?
Marshall is the executive music producer of the original songs that were done for the movie. He worked with Scott Bomar, who from Memphis, who has a band, the Bo Keys,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they recorded at Scott's studio, Electrophonic, and Marshall worked with Scott and the musicians and worked on the arrangements and sang the vocals on the original demo versions and worked with the actors on their singing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And John Paul, you worked with the actors on their sort of bandness.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't sure how to finish that sentence. So.
Yeah, I booked them a gig and ripped them off so they would really get the feel for how to be a musician. No, I coached the actors on miming the guitar,
mm-hmm.
playing and stuff, and the guy that played drums on the sessions, Paul Bucagnani, another Memphis musician, he coached the actor playing the drummer, and they were great. Those actors worked so hard. And they were so talented. Some of them had a little bit of a music background anyway, but they went through boot camp for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Every day we were rehearsing it and miming it. But by the end of the rehearsals, they could play one of the songs all the way through as a band. So when we had the launch party, they got up and played the song. So before we ever started shooting, so it was nice.
John Paul Keith is with us, the singer-songwriter who's playing with his band in the studio today, and we're sort of taking a break from the live music to talk with him and with director Alex Steiermark about this movie called Losers Take All, a musical comedy set in the sort of budding world of indie rock back in 1986. In this scene, the band's manager, Greg, played by Adam Hirschman, is explaining to the band, the Fingers, that he's drawn up a list of people that he has wronged, because, Alex, he's just gotten out of a... out of rehab.
Yeah, right? he went through a little bit of a downward spiral at a certain point, and then now he's gotten his life back together. He wants to make amends.
And so his 12-step program includes the step where you do just that. You make amends to a list of people you've wronged. And the list of people that he has wronged includes Paul Westerberg of The Replacements, whom the manager simply calls up to apologize for a recent mishap.
He was like, "Oh, I know that record, The Fingers. It ain't half bad."
Shut up. You're lying.
And he seemed to actually like the fact that you missed the show because you and Brian had snorted mushrooms.
You don't snort mushrooms, Greg.
You're darn right I don't.
I can't believe that Paul Westerberg knows our record.
Not only that, he said he tried to cover a squirt gun once, but it went horribly wrong. I think they might have some alcohol problems.
And, of course, the one of many in-jokes for folks who were... fans of these bands, The Replacements, notoriously heavy drinkers.
Yeah, so it's said, yeah.
So Squirt Gun is one of the songs by The Fingers. So now who wrote The Fingers songs? Was that Scott?
No, they were all different people. John Paul wrote one. John Crenshaw, Marshall's brother, wrote one. Iris Sertival wrote one.
Jack Oblivion
wrote one.
Okay.
Grant Hart submitted one, didn't he?
Grant Hart submitted
that
one.
Is that one in the film?
That's not in the film.
Not in their book.
The screenwriters actually wrote one. Wayne and Andrew wrote a send-up of a prog rock song called Whale of Victory.
So. Now, do you guys see something of yourselves in these characters? What about you, John Paul, as a veteran, well-traveled musician?
Yeah, I have trouble remembering that age, but yeah. No, I do see myself. Any musician, I think, couldn't help but see themselves in the little band squabbles and the manager mishaps and all that. I mean, every musician who's ever tried to put out a record and do tours has been through that. So, yeah, it was very well written and lovingly written. You could tell that Andrew and Wynn really loved this subject, and really felt for the characters. So that really comes across from the scenes that I was around for.
And Alex, for you, the last time you were on Soundcheck was with the 78 Project, where you record contemporary, recorded, I think it was Justin Townes Earle,
right here in our
studio, on an old 78 RPM player recorder.
Yeah.
So you do tend to look back, it seems. What was it about this period, the alternate/underground rock scene of the 80s that appealed to you?
I mean, for me, it was that's when I really first discovered music that I truly loved and felt like that was mine, that spoke to me, that was being done by people that, were close enough in age. I felt like they were speaking to me, and I think everybody goes through that. And for me, it was those bands. I probably saw 95% of those bands live, so...
So a little Valentine to
it's
those.
A total Valentine. When I read the screenplay, when they approached me about doing the film, and I saw a lot of the songs that you hear in the soundtrack are referenced in the screenplay, I was like, these guys know what they're talking about, and they're talking right to me, and I want to be involved with this movie. So it was great.
The movie is called Losers Take All, and it is available for on-demand viewing beginning this weekend at iTunes and Hulu and cable systems. Alex Steiermark is the director of the film. Alex, great to see you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us back.
And John Paul Keith, the singer-songwriter who's here in the studio with his band, wrote what turned out to be the theme song for the film. He played it for us earlier, but he's not quite done. Here's John Paul Keith and his band with another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. This song is called Everything's Different Now.
One, two, one.
Everything's Different Now, a live performance on Soundcheck from John Paul Keith and his band, with John Paul singing and playing guitar, John R. Groves behind the drums doing some backing vocals, James Godwin on bass. The latest album is called Memphis, circa 3 a.m., and again, you'll hear some of John Paul's music in the new film Anyone Can Do It is the song in the film Losers Take All. The bands that we've been talking about, the Husker Du's, the Replacements, you know, the Guided by Voices of the world, were they? It seems like that's a little bit different from the kind of music you play. Were you fans of the?
Some of that I was, and I was certainly aware of it. I was a little bit young for when that stuff was. You know, I was 11 years old in '86, which is when the movie is set. So I was a little young. And I was into a lot of the hair bands that those bands tried to destroy also. But when you're a kid, you could go through a phase, and 6 months you're into something else.
So I definitely
went through that period, and I'm very familiar with a lot of that music.
You know, there's a moment early in the film where there's a guitarist on stage who, like, you know, breaks format and does this screaming guitar solo. Is that you actually playing, you know, was that guitarist on screen doing that, or was that you, like, dubbing that in?
I think that was my friend Steve Selvage, I think, if I remember correctly. Okay. If it's shredding, it's probably Steve.
Okay.
Steve also played guitar on the sessions. He's now in the Hold Steady, so he's a little busy with that. But
okay.
He's a Memphis guy and a good friend. So I think that was Steve. I'm going to give him the credit on that.
All right. The album, though, all the credit for that goes to John Paul Keith. Well, some of it has to go to the late Roland James,
yes,
the producer who died this week. The album is out, Memphis, circa 3 a.m. John Paul, for you and the band to come in here and play live for us today, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We've had a blast. I appreciate it very much.
I only know a little bit about you. Baby, that's all right. I only know a little, but we got all night. Oh, we got all night. Ain't it nice not knowing where we're going?
As Halloween approaches, all next week on the show, we bring you
Soundcheck's House of Horrors.
Wow, that really does sound terrifying. We'll kick things off by hearing how some of our recent guests have answered this question: who is the scariest musician of all time? You can leave us your answer by calling our voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. The scariest musician of all time. Plus, we'll get a not-at-all-scary live performance from the Brooklyn psychedelic pop quartet known as Teen. That does it for Soundcheck today. I'm John Schaefer. Have a great weekend.